We've been hearing many stories of this tough economy in our series Hard Times, and today we go to Louisville, Kentucky, where a businessman is trying to figure out what's next after selling music for more than a quarter of a century.
My name's John Timmons. I am or was the owner of Ear Ecstasy Records in Louisville, Kentucky. We had a nice run of 26 years here.
Am or was the owner. NPR's Debbie Elliott has our profile.
Dead roses, farewell notes, and other mementos are taped to the glass doors when I arrive at Ear Ecstasy Records.
Debbie, I assume?
Owner John Timmons is waiting in the dark and quiet store to let me in.
Step over the notes that people have been sliding under the door.
It's the first time he's been inside since closing at the end of October.
It's tough to let go. After 26 years, this has been my child.
A child born with a cash advance from a credit card and his personal record collection right out of college. He named the store after the British band XTC, one of his favorites in the 80s. Recently, Timmons went into personal debt again to try to keep the store afloat.
In the last year, I rarely listened to music in my office. It was more about fielding phone calls and talking to creditors and, you know, figuring out how to make the rent or how to make, you know, payroll this week. That's not why I got into this business.
When he closed, he had to let go of the 10 people who worked here. It's a big store, 6,500 square feet, packed with CDs, DVDs, cassettes, albums, just about any medium on which you can listen to a song of any genre.
Barry Manilow's greatest hits.
Timmons thumbs through the vinyl section.
Todd Rundgren, one of my all-time favorite artists here. Joni Rivers, Santana, Boz Scaggs. We run the gamut here. We go from AC/DC to Frank Zappa to who knows.
There's even a stage for live performances. National acts like the Black Keys and the Foo Fighters played free shows here.
You know, most people, when they think of a record store, they think of, a department at Best Buy or Walmart or wherever they're going. But this was more of an experience where you could come in and share your love of music with everybody.
Now, Ear Ecstasy joins the ranks of hundreds like it, another independent music store that just couldn't make it.
Music industry is one thing I've been able to survive, the changes in the music industry. With the downloads, we had a download store online. Kids are buying records now, vinyl's making a resurgence, and that's a growth area. But I have to believe it's just the economy. The last few years have just been brutal for us.
So brutal that last year he made this public plea for business during an emotional news conference.
I'm not asking for a bailout. I'm not asking for a handout. I'm asking for that proverbial hand up.
Today, alone in the store, Timmons is thankful for the customers who stuck with him through the hard times.
I know you've only got X amount of dollars. I don't have money to spend like I did 5 years ago. And I just, you know, people have priorities and music is just not a top priority right now. So that's what's really taken its toll on us.
The timing of the economic downturn couldn't have been worse, Timmons says, given the other pressures on his business. He says while iPods are handy, he still finds pleasure in vinyl.
Let me fire up the turntable here.
He selects the Louisville band, My Morning Jacket.
Song called I'm Amazed.
Contemplating the future is daunting, he says.
I don't know what I'm going to do for a real job now since I've been doing this for 30-something years. I'm 56 years old and, I'm so associated with this store. I'm the Ear Ecstasy guy. Ear Ecstasy goes away, who am I going to be?
Trying to look up, Timmons says at least he'll have time to spend with family this holiday season. He won't be behind a record store counter for the first time in 33 years. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
And you can follow our Hard Times series at npr.org and on Twitter at NPR Hard Times.
Let's talk about a different number now, one the Obama administration hopes to make a reality. Under rules announced by the White House this summer, cars will have to get an average of 55 miles a gallon by 2025. That's nearly twice what the current average is. Reaching that goal will take feats of engineering, and it will require Americans to change how they think about their cars and how they drive them. In the first of a series of stories, NPR's Sonari Glinton looks at how the auto industry plans to get to 55.
It's one of the ways car makers expect to lower their average fuel consumption. The problem is, people aren't buying, whether it's all electric or plug-in hybrid. The Chevy Volt is struggling to sell 10,000 cars this year. Nissan has sold just over 8,000 Leafs. To give you some context, about 13 million cars are expected to be sold this year in the U.S. Brian Brockman is with Nissan. He took me on a test drive of their all-new electric Leaf.
All right, how do I know it's on? Oh, Diane Rehm. Oh, look at you.
Okay, so when you start the vehicle up, obviously you don't have a gas engine under the hood here, so you don't have what you typically think of as a startup sound, which is that engine turning over.
Not only is it quiet, it's also smart. It looks genuinely space-aged. It doesn't fly, but Nissan claims the car gets about 100 miles per charge. Sort of.
Physics naturally takes over, even with these cars. If you go a lot faster, say you're going 80 miles an hour on the highway, you will naturally get more resistance against the car. The car has to work a little bit harder, so the range is going to go down a little bit faster.
So what Brockman doesn't say is you're only going to get that 100-mile range on a cool spring day, doing about 40 miles an hour when you're not using the AC and the car is going downhill. Consumer Reports tested the Leaf. They say it gets an average of about 65 miles on the charge.
So shut the car off with the button.
Speaking of charging, we drove over to a charging station.
So basically you just tap that, it'll unlock the plug, and then you just plug it into the car.
This charging station is at the local power company near Detroit. Problem is, there aren't enough places yet to go get your car charged. And right now, it can take up to 16 hours, depending on what kind of outlet you use. The other problem, what car people call range anxiety.
That feeling in your stomach starts to set in like, oh no, what if I can't make it? And that's part of the problem.
Brian Moody is with the car website, autotrader.com.
People feel like they don't have a grasp on how it works and what the range is. It's sort of like a microwave oven. You know what it does, but you don't know exactly how it does it. It works by magic, and people don't like that.
Once people actually find out about the cars, they like them even less. Craig Giffey is with Deloitte. He recently conducted a study about what people around the world think about electric cars. Giffey says people like the idea of electric cars. That's the good news.
The bad news is that the technology is currently at a point where they have to make trade-offs. So they want that same vehicle. They want it to look and feel the same. They also want it to perform the same, which means they want it to go as far. They want to be able to refuel it, or in this case, recharge it quickly.
Nobody's expecting those changes to happen anytime soon. Again, Brian Moody with autotrader.com.
The problem is the chances of there being a 500-mile range electric car. At this point, it seems pretty unlikely. Because you can go to the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan and see electric cars. To me, that's not great progress.
My name is Bob Casey, and I'm the Senior Curator of Transportation at the Henry Ford.
Casey took me on the tour of the Henry Ford Car Museum in Dearborn, Michigan.
This, by the way, this electric car was Clara Ford's. Henry's wife drove an electric car.
Like today, electric cars in Clara Ford's day couldn't do what gas-powered cars could. So electric car makers had to turn to niche markets.
And one place where there was a demand for electric cars was among well-to-do urban women. They're quiet. They're clean. If you're living in a city, you don't have to go very far. If you're wealthy, you can install a charger in your home or in your garage. And if you're wealthy, you can afford these things because they were expensive.
Not that much has changed with electric cars in more than 100 years. Casey says if they're to be widely adopted, it's drivers themselves and their habits that will need to change. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
NPR national security correspondent Rachel Martin has been looking into one aspect of the federal deficit, and that is the defense budget.
The Pentagon budget is complicated, to say the least, so I sought out some help from an expert guide. Hi, Todd, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Todd Harrison.
I'm a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
Which means he knows a whole lot about the U.S. defense budget. I started with a big, basic question. Why is the defense budget such an easy target when it comes to cutting the deficit? He said, first off, the defense budget makes up half of the entire discretionary budget for the federal government, so it's always a target. The second reason is that the budget's not just big, it's growing.
The DoD budget grew, including war funding, by over 70% over the past decade. Even if you exclude war funding, it still grew by close to 40%.
Why?
So I looked at this in my last budget analysis, and over the past decade, the number of people in the military in active duty actually remained about the same.
Harrison says what happened is that personnel costs skyrocketed, mainly incentives to keep service members from quitting during wartime. Congress added pay raises for troops every year, and the Pentagon keeps paying more for health care and pensions.
So as a result, the cost per person and the military increased by 46% in real terms over the past decade.
Now, the Pentagon has already been asked to cut more than $450 billion from its budget. But if the Super Committee fails to make a deal, then automatic defense cuts kick in, up to another $600 billion. And even if there is a deal, the Pentagon could face another couple hundred billion in cuts. I asked Todd Harrison to give me his take on two big parts of the budget where there might be potential savings. First, that war funding he mentioned earlier. The war in Iraq is drawing down by the end of this year. The war in Afghanistan by the year 2014. How much money does the United States save when those wars come to a close, if any?
So it's all about what baseline you're comparing to.
A baseline, basically a starting point, one that assumes that you're going to spend the same amount of money every year. For example, last year, the U.S. spent more than $150 billion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That amount, over 10 years, gives you a projected cost of $1.6 trillion. But as the wars wind down, the costs will too.
War funding is projected to drop to $118 billion in FY12, and it'll continue dropping in FY13 and beyond. So in reality, we're not going to spend $1.6 trillion on the wars over the next decade. We're more likely to spend $300 or $400 billion.
So when people say that's an area where we can count savings, that's legitimate?
How do I say this? It is a gimmick because it's not real savings.
So that's war spending. What about cutting weapons programs, planes, ships, and tanks?
Acquisition programs are an attractive target when you're trying to find budget savings, particularly when you need to find the savings quickly. So I suspect DoD's acquisition programs are going to bear the brunt of the budget cuts.
But Harrison says that doesn't make it the smartest place to cut. He says once you stop building some sectors of the defense industrial base, it's hard to jumpstart them again.
You know, no private companies are buying nuclear-powered submarines or stealthy fighter jets. And so if DoD does not continue some level of steady funding for these industries, free market forces will just eliminate them.
So if all the savings can't come from ending the wars or cutting weapons purchases, where are the rest? Harrison points to the issue that inflated the defense budget in the first place, personnel. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta has said military health care premiums could go up and salaries may get scaled back. But Harrison says the military has to think bigger, anticipate the threats 10, 20 years down the line. Only then can the Pentagon decide what it can cut now and what it can't. Rachel Martin, NPR News, Washington.
Of course, only one Republican will win the party's presidential nomination, but for the remaining contenders, there can be other benefits. Case in point, most of the current GOP hopefuls have written books, and so their campaigns can double as book tours. As we hear from NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne, sometimes it's hard to tell the politics from the promotional events.
Books by presidential candidates are nothing new. It's a time-honored device to lay out both a personal story and policy proposals. The all-time sales champ in this category is Barack Obama's The Audacity of Hope. This is from the audio version.
An up-or-out strategy was how I described it to my wife. One last shot to test out my ideas before I settled into a calmer, more stable, and better-paying existence.
In the current campaign, the bookshelf is loaded. There's Mitt Romney's No Apology. He talked about the book on the Today Show last year.
Frankly, this is a book that flows from my many years of experience in the private sector and business going around the world. I think America's got some real challenges.
Texas Governor Rick Perry's book is called Fed Up. He, too, went on the Today Show before he was a candidate.
If there is a better signal of my plans for the future of not running for the presidency of the United States, it's this book. Anyone running for the presidency is not going to go take on these issues with the power that I do.
Texas Congressman Ron Paul, meanwhile, has been writing books for many years. His most recent is called Liberty Defined. He visited The View this year before officially jumping into the race.
So there are rumors you're going to run again this time. Are you
there,
going to?
There, I've heard about those rumors.
Longtime publisher Peter Osnos has worked on political books. He says it's a medium where the candidate has total control.
A book has a great virtue. It's just you and the reader. There is no interviewer. There's nobody to get in the way.
Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann releases her new book next week. That's actually kind of late. But Bachmann, who has slumped in the polls after a strong start, will use the occasion to reintroduce herself to voters. But the co-mingling of candidate books and the campaign itself raises some questions. Dennis Goldford is a political scientist at Drake University.
You can ask, in a way, is the book there to sell a presidential candidacy? But in some cases, you may wonder if the candidacy is there to sell the book.
Which brings us to two candidates who stand out in this field for their aggressive approach to product promotion. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich and businessman Herman Cain. Gingrich is a prolific author writing on politics and history. He's co-authored a brand new novel set during the Civil War, and he produces movies. This trailer is from a Gingrich-produced film called A City Upon a Hill.
Exceptionalism for Americans is the belief that the United States is, in some way, more open, more vigorous, more optimistic than other nations are.
Additionally, emails from Gingrich are often about a movie or book he's selling. Cain's book, meanwhile, is called This Is Herman Cain. His travel schedule has prompted many to wonder if it's all really about selling books. Visits to Iowa have been rare. Instead, he's been in Arkansas, Tennessee, Wisconsin, and other places far from the early caucus and primary action. Cain addressed the assertion that his ultimate goal is to land a TV show, like former candidate Mike Huckabee did after his failed 2008 presidential run.
If you know Herman Cain, you know that that's nothing is further from the truth. And if you don't believe me, I invite you to get a copy of my new book, This Is Herman Cain. No, if you can find one, because they are selling like hotcakes.
Cain made those comments before allegations of past sexual harassment and an awkward answer to a question about Libya went viral. Any candidate would worry about the impact of such things on a political campaign. But selling oneself as an author or TV host or commentator is another matter. Constituents there can be much more forgiving. Don Gagne, NPR News.